Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
This is a Lip Media podcast.
We acknowledge the traditional owners of the land on which we are recording. We pay our respects to the elders past and present, and the Aboriginal elders of other communities who may be listening today. Welcome to The Gays Revolting, a definitive weekly news source for contemporary gays.
We put the G in LGBTQIA+, and we're here to help you be the best G you can be.
You can follow us on Instagram at Gays Revolting Pod, or join our Facebook group at The Gays Are Revolting.
And if you'd like to support the podcast and listen to our after shows, head over to patreon.com/gaysrevoltingpod for a heap of extra content. Welcome to the show. We have our three regular hosts and a special guest. I am the reincarnation of Keeping Up Appearances, John Inman, and my name's Thomas Jaspers.
And I love every Jennifer Lopez movie unconditionally. I'm Kyle.
Made in Manhattan.
Even that. Oh,
that's the best one.
Yeah, I know, right? It's so good.
And I'm the sexiest member of the FBI's most wanted list. Luke.
And we're joined by a very special guest, Thomas. Thomas, do you want to read yourself?
Yeah, I just came up with this off the top of my head. The love child of Shirley MacLaine and an actual ibis, Thomas Wilson White.
Amazing. Hello, Thomas. How are you?
I'm good.
We're so excited to be joined by you. You're a wonderful filmmaker.
Thank you.
We'll do more of your CV in a little bit. First of all, how's everyone's week been?
Yeah, pretty good. I think still recovering from the weekend.
Yeah, we got fucked up, didn't we?
A little bit.
Yeah. Love that for you.
Kyle and I went to Joel Creasy's birthday and we got very messed up. Am I allowed to tell them what happened to you at DT's?
Yeah, I just got very drunk and don't remember a lot of DT's.
We had to he wouldn't drink water, so we had to ask the bar to make a drink that looked like water.
No, so it looked like drink, you mean sorry, like alcohol.
It looked like alcohol, but it was actually water. So the bartender was like, oh no, I know what I'm doing, and he got like lime and ice and like grenadine and put it all into me.
Made a big cocktail for me. Yeah. And then apparently I made a big show of like sculling it, like I'm really hardcore.
Yeah.
And there was no alcohol.
And then there was like 60 people at the party, and then we all went out. We went to DT's, then went to Puff Doof.
Yes.
And of the 60 people, even though I had a broken leg, I was the last person standing.
So
I stayed out till Monday morning.
You're a crazy person, Tom.
I know, I'm fucked up. And
it's Tuesday today for our listeners.
Yes. So if I start crying in this episode, you know why.
I'm also recovering. I bought my first 1,000-piece puzzle.
Oh, wow. Weekend. Gosh, you are wild.
I know.
You're an 80-year-old person.
I picked a Van Gogh painting.
Okay.
So it's actually the most infuriating thing I've ever committed to.
Have you ever seen this? My parents do this, and I think they're just trying to ruin their own relationship. They do like puzzles that are just all like blue.
I saw that recently on social media. It was like a 1,000-piece puzzle, and it was all just black
one
pieces.
Color.
I was
are
you kidding me?
Oh, that sounds great.
Also, what do you do with it afterwards?
Just get a divorce.
Can't get a frame.
And what I like to do when I go and visit mum and dad is every now and then I'll go into the games cupboard and just take one piece of the puzzle out of the box and
you're
take it home
monster.
With me, and then wait till they're doing it.
There's a special place in hell for you.
Yeah.
I've been at MIFF all week, the Melbourne International Film Festival.
You're so cultured, Thomas. Good on you.
Thank you so much. I've seen lots of European films and have more or less been drunk for like 2 weeks straight, which is
amazing.
Pretty fucked up, actually. Like,
nice.
Amazing.
And what's your highlight from the film festival that you were not involved in the production of the film?
I saw, there's like a Ukrainian queer film called And Then We Danced about two like Georgian dancers who fall in love. It was super hot and beautiful.
Gorgeous.
But also, I mean, spoiler alert, they don't end up together, which is one of my pet peeves, but we can talk about that later.
Oh, it's so common in queer cinema, though.
And our lives, apparently.
Yeah.
So there you go.
Yes. Absolutely.
Yes. You never get the boy.
But MIFF has been amazing this year.
Great.
It's been cool.
So as we said, we're so excited to be joined by Thomas Wilson White. You're an award-winning film director, screenwriter, and script editor.
Correct.
So you're visiting us from Sydney for a screening of your film St. Augustine at the Melbourne International Film Festival.
Yes. St. Augustine is a short proof of concept that I made for the second feature film that I want to make soon. And it's like a sea thriller about two men who go away together and the protagonist becomes aware of maybe a third person in their relationship.
Now, for us uncultured queens, a proof of concept film,
it's almost a
preview. I know, I'm familiar with film. I have Pornhub. A proof of concept is sort of like you're making a little sample of the film so you can shop it around and then create a full length.
Yeah, it was sort of, we made it as a process tool to, I wrote the feature film and went, this is shit, it's not what I wanted to be. So then wrote a short film that kind of had the themes and the characters and went to my producer, let's go away and test this out and see if it works. And obviously it has, which was lovely, and is now helping me get traction for the feature film.
That's fantastic. Awesome. Yeah.
Have you ever considered adding maybe three podcasters
in the cast? Because we're very available. Except for Tuesday nights, we're very available.
No, I'm just going to wait for Mikey to come back, actually.
Oh, yeah. No, yeah.
He's my favourite.
Yeah, he is the heartthrob.
He's our favourite too.
Yeah, he's our favourite. We miss
him. No, for a second there, I actually forgot. I was just like, who's Mikey?
It's me.
Yes. Yeah. You're the new one.
Now, we got treated to a scene.
Did you watch it last night?
Yes, we did. Yeah, it's fantastic.
Cool. Okay.
It explores the ways modern queer men are still burdened with toxic masculine ideas, which is something we've talked about a lot on this podcast. And it's also something you've previously said that you struggle with in your own life. How do you think queer men overcome that sort of pressure to be masc?
Good question. I think the definition of queerness, I think, is to kind of like tilt everything a little bit and kind of look at things from a new angle.
Yeah.
And I find as a queer man, I think I just assumed that I was like, fine. I was like, yeah, I came out. I'm like proudly gay. I do, you know, anal. So, you know, you're sort of like...
Me too.
I love that about all four of us. No, you're definitely like, you think you're across it. And then I think it was when I started having relationships with men, like long-term stuff. Yeah. I started realizing there was some intimacy issues and problems with me in terms of like these roadblocks I would keep hitting. And it all came back to this idea of masculinity and I don't know, I guess I just struggled to reconcile that in myself. I think a lot of us do. I think some of my favorite parts of myself are more traditionally feminine elements, and then other favorite parts are traditionally masculine parts. And I think we all walk that narrow path.
Totally.
It's
cool getting to talk to you about it because often when you see, especially more artistic films as opposed to, you know, your Hollywood comedies,
Pornhub. You could just say
you know what the film's about. There's no underlying tones, you know.
Yeah.
It's kind of cool to be able to sit here and ask you questions. When I watched it personally, one thing that stood out for me, there was obviously the element of the toxic masculinity and that sort of stuff. But I was watching it and I got a big sense, because in the short film, it's two guys away for the weekend of what
both
seems like a romantic,
beautiful guys. Oh my gosh.
What seems to be sort of, you know, a romantic getaway for them. And the sense that I got, because there's not a lot of dialogue in the film, so a lot of it's sort of interpreted by the viewer. One thing that I really took from it is that inability a lot of gay men, and certainly myself and a lot of people I've spoken with, to live in the moment of happiness and enjoy something. I feel like a lot of the time when we're having these beautiful weekends away or even just a hookup or whatever, I can't sit there and enjoy it for what it is because I'm constantly aware that it's got to end and I have to go back to mainstream environments and I don't get to walk down the street holding hands with this person. Is that something you intentionally put in there or am
massively,
I reading?
Massively. Yeah? And cool. I think I usually write very dialogue-heavy work and this is the first time I've gone... I think because one of the huge attributes of toxic masculinity is like an inability to articulate. And I really thought I'm going to quite literally make a film where the protagonist can't say what the fuck it is that he's struggling with. And I think that kind of has allowed audience members to interpret what they want out of the film, which is amazing because I think what you end up doing is you kind of end up projecting into the characters and saying, well, I think somebody watched it and read that he'd lost his twin brother. Somebody else thought his mum had died.
Right, of course,
all these elements that I actually put in the film as well. And I think for me, it was just really important that I didn't prescribe too much because I think when something gets prescriptive, a wider audience can kind of go, well, I haven't necessarily experienced that trauma, so I'm going to stop. I'm going to drop out.
Yeah,
I'm
going to
stop connecting.
Yeah, yeah.
And to be perfectly frank, like it's stuff that I have not dealt with fully in myself. And I thought this is so amorphous and sort of fluid and, I don't know, kind of scary for me. I just want to kind of present the story and say, help me. help me unpack it. You know?
And sometimes when you're making something, you don't fully have a grasp on the idea until it's like finished. And talking to a lot of people that are screenwriters and directors, sometimes it's not until the audience starts talking back to them that you realize, oh,
that's what that was.
That is what that thing is about.
And I guess all art is really a way for the creator to explore things that they're trying to work out.
I think the best art is always going to be hopefully an open-ended conversation. You don't want to be didactic and you don't want to force an audience to, like, this is what I believe and I am right. Because you just shut off. Like, when have we ever listened to somebody?
Directors and stuff, like, really want you to get that specific thing, and if they'd be offended if you, like, had kind of no idea if you thought it was something else. So
yeah,
really
it depends on the director, I think. I think David Lynch, who's, I'm a big fan of David Lynch, and he sort of says, and he sort of says, I don't know what the answer is. I put it all there and you decide. And I think in that way, you're inviting your audience to really interact on an individual level with your work. And hopefully it sticks in their brain a little bit longer because of that.
Choose your own adventure.
Because I used to have... Mulholland Drive is one of my favorite films of all time. And when that came out, I remember going on message boards because we didn't really have a Reddit and stuff back then. And like reading officially what this film is about. And the DVD had like a case that had David Lynch's 12 clues to like unraveling the mystery. And they were just random things like watch the position of the blue key. Like things that actually made it more confusing than what the plotline was. But then when you watch interviews with David Lynch himself, he's like, it's kind of up to you. And if I told you what it was, it would kind of wreck it. Or like it would take away the possibility of it being something else. So...
very similar to Sex in the City 2.
I
think also very deep and undertoned.
I think he was signed on to that originally.
He was going to work on that,
scheduling conflicts he had to pull out. Now, you've done your master's in queer theory and cinema. We're going to talk a bit about queer cinema in general
later in the episode.
So stay tuned for that. Now, part of the VCA screenwriting course was to date me for at least a year. Like, it's a world that I was ingrained in for a little bit. So I've watched a lot of people write scripts and work on screenplays. When you're writing something or working on a script, especially taking into consideration identifying as queer, for me there are certain things that are always stay away from that, or like things that are no buenos for you when it comes to representation.
Yeah, I think I was raised, I've got two mums, so I was raised in like a kind of alternative family, and four queer siblings as well. So got a
that
big gay family unit.
That is so cool.
It's great. So the plebiscite meant a lot to us. But I found in the last couple of years, I've been really keen to explore alternative family dynamics and making sure that we are representing families that are different to the normal sort of family drama. There's kind of this like self-fulfilling prophecy in cinema as well, where like we all die or we end up unhappy or we lose the love interest or it's a tragedy. That's kind of why I kind of didn't come out as a queer filmmaker for a while, because I was like, but that means I just have to make sad
movies. That film.
It really like boxes.
Which is really an exciting, there's an exciting gap in the market actually of like, not like Love, Simon, which made me want to hit myself with a brick, but films that have a positive ending, queer joy, queer celebration, like a bit more complex representation of queer lives, you know, without it ever being necessarily about sexuality. That's kind of the work that I want to make.
Yeah, they're even character tropes and things. Like watching some of my exes write, I'd be like, oh, you can't put that character in. You know, there's always a Tom.
Oh, fuck off.
You want to have me around.
You know, in queer cinema, you know that character, you know that character, you know that character. And sometimes my ex would write and I'd be like, oh, please, you were doing so well. Why did you go down?
Yeah. Every story needs a Tom.
I know. That's why we have a Tom. So are there any tropes or characters that you just absolutely are like?
I mean, to be honest, like, I don't write Yas queen ever mm-hmm. into my dialogue. Like, I try and avoid
writing. I wish Luke would stop putting it into our dialogue.
He spends like an hour editing it out and me clicking over
it. Now that
everything.
I've said that, I'm probably going to say it tonight 100 times. I try and avoid writing overtly flamboyant male, mm-hmm. white male gay characters. Mm-hmm. I think the other thing is that trans and non-binary characters can often be kind of relegated to the peripheries mm-hmm. and almost used as a plot device or something grossy yeah. like that. And I think I'm trying to really make sure that I am avoiding writing characters, I don't know, that are peripheral or die in a really gruesome mm-hmm. way. Like, the other trope that I actually hate now that we're talking about it is like serial killers who are also like bi or gay, like right. before they go and shoot up a school, they have sex in a shower with their brother or some shit, right. which is what yeah. I've seen a few times.
Yeah.
And I'm like, I mean, Silence of the Lambs did it.
Mm-hmm. Elephant?
Like, you know what I mean?
Elephant?
Yeah, that's exactly what I'm... Yeah, yeah. And like, I think it's this old trope of like the lesbian killer or the gay yeah, guy yeah. who mm. is also kind of a deviant and mm-hmm. also wants to wear your face and murder you. It's like... I want to avoid that desperately.
I
want to
wear your ass and marry you.
I knew you were really joking. I'm glad someone said it.
They did also make Freddy Krueger gay.
What?
In the
Shut
second,
up.
The second Nightmare,
Freddy Krueger,
the second no. Nightmare on Elm Street, film
the worst handjob giver ever,
is a gay film.
Oh, well, how? Boy, what happens?
He's basically Freddy is trying to possess the body of like no. a hunky 80s frat boy.
Well, don't we all?
And half the film is set in like the school showers and the locker room, and the coach has.
Did
some
you watch this on Pornhub?
Whipping fetish. Yeah. It's a gay film. Is it? It's a gay film.
Freddy's the one with like
the scissor hands, and he's like the bronze victim. Him, fedora, you know,
it's all too scary for me.
The fedora is the scariest part for me.
Yes, Freddy.
The horizontal stripes jumper. No, not doing it. Thomas, I saw that you're also working on a musical.
Yes.
Number. No. Number.
You're a
baby drag.
A little for us now. Yeah. No, sorry. Musical feature. Can you tell us about the premise of that?
I actually don't technically know what I can speak about that, which is super sexy and cool.
Ooh, how exciting.
It is about Rocker Steadfords.
Okay.
And it possibly stars somebody we were speaking about before mm-hmm. who your boyfriend hates. So for those in the audience, I don't know. It's her name rhymes with Shmoni Shmelette.
That's really cool. After show.
But it's going to be very cool. It's sort of like in my head, there's like a really serious, moody gay guy, and then the other half of my brain is like a 15-year-old girl who is doing high kicks, so I get to exercise that
Rocker
part
Steadford
of my brain.
Is so fucking funny, though.
It's it is, like, and it's underexplored in cinema.
Literally amazing.
The hours I spent on that at school.
Yeah.
Did they have it internationally? Like,
I don't know.
I
have no idea what
it is. Okay, so Rocker Steadford. Oh, yeah, you went to school in South Africa. So, yeah, sorry, Rocker Steadford is. Your school puts together a giant number that goes for about 10 minutes. I think it's usually a mashup of songs with costumes and sets and dances and that sort of stuff. I think different states might even have different names for it. And then you go to like Rod Laver Arena. It's massive.
Oh, what?
Yeah. And they sell tickets to all the parents and stuff.
So it's like schools versus schools.
Yeah, schools versus schools.
But the hook is that it's funded by Quit for Life. So it had to have like this political anti-drugs message.
Oh, I don't remember the message.
So it's like so it's 15-year-olds ostensibly going, refugees, let's do something about that, and then dressing up as refugees and dancing for 8 minutes.
And it's on TV, don't they?
The winners are broadcast nationally.
Yeah, because I saw one about land rights.
Right.
I remember one about like Marlboro.
All of them. It's
ours
amazing.
Was called Friday at Flinders Street Station. I can't really remember the political message behind it.
Love
but
that.
Sure.
Sounds like a movie of Rebel Wilson.
Yeah, I played Rebel Wilson, yeah. the talentless, annoying person.
Oh.
Oh, you're still playing her. I love that.
Oh, my God, I'm so sorry.
Thomas is never coming back on this podcast.
He's spicy.
Now, you've also worked with Heaps Gay, who we love,
yes,
and the City of Sydney on a series of documentary shorts called Voice Recordings, aimed at exploring philosophy and spirituality from the queer perspective. Is the intersection of sexuality and spirituality something that you're passionate about exploring?
Absolutely.
And also, like, does that come from life experience?
It does. So I think, as I said before, I was raised by two women, and last year I nursed one of my mums in her late stage leukemia battle.
Oh, sorry to hear that.
Thank you. And she passed away in December. Mm-hmm. And it was really profound for me, I think, observing medically the intersection of end of life as well with a lesbian identifying woman mm-hmm. who was my mum. And I learned a lot about sort of the gaps in what we are documenting in terms of queer culture. Like, I think we talk a lot about plebiscite, Mardi Gras, marriage equality, mm-hmm. these really charged political spaces, but we don't often get to talk about just our spiritual beliefs or philosophically what we think happens after you die. Mm-hmm. And I spent a lot of time with her talking about that, which was obviously something that came up all the time. And I think it just became a fascinating subject for me. Mm-hmm. In hindsight, I think I moved home to look after her because I really needed a ritual around mm-hmm. the end of her life and saying goodbye to her. And I think in Western culture, we don't really have rituals around death. So that became something that I think has now absorbed me fully and I'm making a much larger docu-series about the same thing now too.
Yeah. And was your childhood a spiritual childhood, or is that something that sort of came into your mum's life later?
We were Hillsong.
So right. Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
Like before, I know. So before my mum came out.
Of course, you're ticking a lot of boxes.
Oh, mate, I know, literally. Before mum came out, we were Hillsong, and my dad is still quite insanely involved. Overtly religious. Wow. He's a no-voter. Uh-huh. We still love him. But yeah, so I think we were raised spiritual, and then obviously you come out and you're like aggressively excluded from organized religion, but ergo like spirituality. Mm-hmm. So I think I have always felt myself to be a spiritual person, but like deeply hate Christianity and get like tight chested and hyperventilate when people talk to me about God.
Right, yeah.
You know? So I'm sorry.
Sorry, no, keep going.
So I guess what I'm trying to do is go like, where do I sit as a queer man in that landscape? Yeah.
And just out of my own, just if you don't mind talking about it a bit more, your aversion to Christianity, does that sort of spread to all organized religion or
No, not at all. Right. I think literally Hillsong. Pentecostal.
Do you identify with any specific religion then?
No.
Just more spiritual person.
Your
mum, both mums were?
Yeah, they were atheists, basically. Mm-hmm. But I think my now surviving mum, we've had a lot of profound conversation about it since, you know, what happened in that like brief window towards the end of my mum Polly's life, you know, what we all felt and what and those discoveries, you know, with her along the way, it was quite moving and challenging. Mm. And I think once the door opened, it was like open again for me. And I was like... And I don't know if that's just a selfish need to feel closure and peace for her or something, but it is fascinating to me that I can't look around and see any queer people.
You're right. It's definitely something that's not really explored in our community.
Absolutely. Yeah. But it's been amazing. Like, I'm working with ACON, the Queer Health Organization, to find the subjects for the next series, and they have queer Muslim leaders, you know, that I can talk to. And I'm like, throw it all at me. Like, I want to talk to as many people as I can about this and see what we are all believing.
Mm-hmm. I'd love to talk about the afterlife on this show.
Oh my gosh. <new topic>.
I thought you were talking about Akon the rapper.
Oh my god.
Oh my god, dude, this happened. Yes.
My ears broke. I'm like, I know Akon.
Yeah, no, I went along with it. And I was like, he's like a queer advocate now. And this person I was talking to, because I was just kind of really bored. So I thought I'd just kind of make fun of them.
Let them do it.
Yeah. So the good news is Thomas is also sticking around for the whole show. You do not know what you are. So thank you for having a chat to us about your film. Is that screening?
It's
at
screening
this...
literally tonight at 9 p.m. Oh, right. So I'm Ubering from here to there.
Okay.
Wow.
Okay.
But it will be on other screens somewhere in the future in around Australia, hopefully on Vimeo at some point.
On Vimeo. Yeah. So if people Google, they'll be able to.
Correct.
View it.
Thanks so much also for sharing your family story with us as well.
Thank you.
Very grateful for that. It's beautiful.
Thank you.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Now, I thought since we have a director on the show this week, it would be a good time to discuss more broadly our thoughts about queer cinema. A quote that I saw recently that really started the gears going was, I think it was Todd Haynes, the director, had posed the question, what exactly is queer cinema? And it is something that bugged me ever since a kid. I don't know if you guys remember Borders, the like
bookstore.
The bookstore.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And I used to go there as a teenager, and this bookstore would also sell music and films, and they would have a gay/queer section. And I'd go in there and be like, some of the stuff is in here just because it's made by a queer person.
Yeah, right.
Or like, this isn't queer music. Mm. This is a folk album. Why does it have to be in the queer section? Mm. And so I thought, there is this kind of weird, loose definition of what queer makes
film is. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Queer film, queer films, because I don't necessarily think it should be solely defined by the fact that potentially there's a homosexual character in the film.
Yeah.
I always thought queer film was defined that it would have to be depressing to watch. Oh my God, that was my interpretation of it.
It is
kind of why I've always
steered
clear of it a lot. Only in my recent years, I would say, I've kind of started to like try and watch some things.
I think because I bought you all those DVDs on your birthday.
Got some DVDs. But it's definitely something I've never had much of an interest in, because I've always thought that's the more depressing side of being gay, and I don't want to feel sad. I want to feel happy about it. So
I think there's a fascinating thing that we all did growing up, which is like you learn to project yourself and your wants and needs and desires into like Sarah Jessica Parker and be like okay with
specifically
that.
Specifically
her. And only her. And I think it's interesting to me because I avoided queer cinema and also just had no access to it. Like I was I was in like lockdown in this Christian household for a very long time. It was like the film Room, actually. Like, I'm kidding. And so there's this period of my life where I wasn't identifying as a queer filmmaker because I hadn't seen enough of it and I didn't feel like I belonged there. But then once I started watching a lot of queer cinema and work made by queer directors and stuff, I was like, oh my God, there's things on screen that I it resonated with me in a way that nothing else had before. And I realized that I'd kind of been like suspending my disbelief into a straight white woman to survive and to get my kicks, you know?
I think why film is so important to me and queer cinema in particular is because being a bit introverted, films are a real source of escapism. It's also quite aspirational in a lot of ways too, and films also taught me about the world outside of me, because I was so introverted, I spent a lot of time in my head. So my struggles with queer cinema was the fact that there were so many depressing or doom and gloom stories, because I was trying to seek out some worldview or some semblance of where my life was going to go and what I could aspire to through these characters and films. And we mentioned Love, Simon, which is, I think, the classic catch-22 or whatever, where you do actually get, I'm assuming, I'm not going to go see that film, quite an aspirational, positive gay love story.
Correct.
But it's like, I am never going to watch that film.
No.
You know, so it's this weird, like, love-hate relationship I have where I love My Own Private Idaho. I love Weekend. Lilting. But when I think about it, they're all films where the characters end up
super depressing,
alone. The thing I want from queer cinema is I do think it should represent or give some idea for what life is actually going to be like.
Some realistic.
Yeah.
Also, don't you think like a lot of queer cinema, like all the really famous stuff is quite old, and it's a very different representation of what being queer at the time was? So it was very hard and depressing at the time. So I'd definitely like to see some more happier things and like more positive current day stuff that are more uplifting.
I'm kind of embarrassed to have you on while we talk about this topic, Tom, because my knowledge of queer cinema is fairly mainstream. I love like Party Monster.
Great. Love that.
Hedwig and the Angry Inch, and probably my favorite, well, obviously, it's Priscilla, but I think that's fairly mainstream. But one of my favourite Australian queer cinema pieces is The Sum of Us, the Australian movie with Russell Crowe and Jack Thompson, which is based on the play, which I actually really want to get redone, and I would love to be in it if anyone wants to produce it. But what I do know about it and what I love about queer cinema is it doesn't really have to follow the same conventions that mainstream cinema does follow. And I think that's, like, we've talked a lot before about how our relationships and our lifestyles, in a way, we're kind of, it's the silver lining of being a queer person, is that our lives aren't laid out in front of us, and that means our relationships aren't laid out in front of us, and then the storylines of our movies or the way that our movies are made made are also quite experimental and different, yeah. and can have storylines where you don't know what the ending's going to be. And so, yeah, sometimes that means that they are depressing and end with people, you know, dying of HIV, as a lot of the older films have had, or ending up lonely or whatever. But it is a very different...
Why did you look at me when you said
that? I can say that.
But you know what I mean? It is kind of exciting.
I agree. I think for me, like, I want options. Like, and I feel like it's quite exciting to be alive in a time where I can say that. Mm-hmm. I want variety in all sorts of stories and all sorts of people on screen. And so, Love, Simon killed me in a way because I think it was trying to fit like a square into a circle. And it's like, well, we don't have Jennifer Garner and Josh Duhamel as our parents. And we don't have like a best... I mean, because obviously I'd be incest if Josh Duhamel was my God. But I feel like...
Yeah. No, agree. Sorry. Like, I wasn't judging you. I was agreeing.
But I feel like that you can't actually take that sort of like rom-com coming-of-age high school formula and make it queer authentically. I feel like a lot of people maybe watched that and was like, cute, but I think it was actually straight-facing, to be honest. Okay. I think that film was facing out to all of our dads and mums who don't understand our life. Who were like, it was beautiful.
But to play devil's advocate then, and I'm not saying this is what I think, but just hearing you say that, is there sort of something important about those films being made then, if it is educating people in the mainstream and if it is the only way of reaching them, whilst we don't have to enjoy it, is it sort of important?
Absolutely. And I agree. But I also would argue that if it feels inauthentic to an actual queer audience,
then we can't call it then queer cinema.
Well, you can just go, I understand why you don't want to see it, Luke. Yeah. You know, like it's kind of like...
It's sort of the Will and Grace of... Yeah. Of
love queers. Will and Grace, don't you?
It's fantastic. You wouldn't say it's an edgy kind of gritty, realistic...
But arguably did a lot for the queer movement in the early 2000s. Just to have being that on prime presence, time is insane.
Which always goes back to the same argument that I made like several different times about John Inman on IE being served being very important to be visible in a time when there was no invisible.
I agree.
What you said about structure, I think, is really important. Like, Love, Simon doesn't classify as a queer film to me because it sticks to some conventions. Yeah. Like, that should just be in the family drama section of the imaginary borders in my mind. But if you think about John Waters and the films that he would make, not a lot of them were explicitly focusing on gay themes or like, but all of them are under the umbrella of queer cinema because they broke rules. Mm. They were films for outsiders. Mm-hmm. And that to me, I think, is the essence of queer cinema, especially from that time period specifically. Mm. But MIFF is such a great time of year to actually see what current queer filmmakers are doing and making. And you don't often get the opportunity to see these films because they're not given theatrical releases. Yeah. Mm. So I really recommend to go and grab a booklet and have a look through.
I literally just typed in LGBT into the search function and just booked every film that I could see.
That's great.
Because I think it's fascinating to see the sort of where the films are coming from as well, like in terms of the countries that are making the work. And often it's not Western countries that are making the most subversive or like, you know, fresh queer content, I would argue.
Well, yeah, they always say like out of oppression can come the best art.
Absolutely,
And so some of the countries probably that are not going through the great rights movements that we're going,
but I think you will find that we are making like a, like say Brokeback Mountain, for instance, even though it's like kind of 20 years ago.
Is that 20 fucking years ago?
Yeah, 2001, I think.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
Oh god, I'm old.
I went to the movies to see that.
I haven't seen
it. I'm so sorry.
I saw it when, oh my god, I'm so old.
Sorry,
I guess what I was going to say is like it's a period piece because you have the high stakes that you need to tell that story in America at that time.
Yeah, true, yeah.
And then I think as we, I mean, America's fucked, but as we get more progressive, there are less stakes, I think, to have an open relationship, possibly between at least between like two literal models, who are dressed as cowboys. So I think you do start to find that this insanely exciting work is coming from places where there is still a lot of oppression and you know, lines between people.
Yeah. Huh. Did you see Tangerine?
No, I haven't seen it. I should have.
So Tangerine is this incredible indie film that was shot, I think, entirely on iPhone.
It was,
On iPhone?
Yeah. And it just is the classic one night in the life of a trans sex worker.
Yeah.
That, to me, is such essential queer cinema viewing because it's like a little rough around the edges, but it's portraying literally like what is happening out in the world right now. And I think my disappointment with the tropes and the stories is that I understand historically that there was an important place for that and for those stories, and we have told those stories, and they're available, and queer people will seek out media.
Absolutely.
Yeah. We can see.
Oh, God. Like, I remember as a kid, like, staying up watching SBS just in the hope of getting something that
I remember I have
could
some
be in
memories.
A different language, and you would just like, sit there and watch it at
still have a
12
wank.
Years yeah. old. Yeah. You know? Yeah, have a wank and just.
Oh, wow. Now, I was going to say, one of my first memories, like, of moving to Australia, I was living with my grandparents in Cairns. I didn't really have many friends at the time, and, like, on the weekends, I'd stay up and watch SBS. And I didn't even know there were queer films at the time, and I'd just be watching these really beautiful foreign movies. And I thought, like, the settings of them were really beautiful. And then all of a sudden, there would be, like, two guys making out, like, oh my God, I shouldn't be watching this. But it was just this really nice thing, and it was just like me. Thing. Alone, everyone was asleep, and I was just like, no one knew. And so,
you'd have the volume down really low, and
you'd have your ear
next to the speaker of the TV.
I just had those yellow subtitles at the bottom, so I could just follow it really easily.
But you couldn't hear them fuck.
Oh, yeah.
Just a little bit.
And to this day, he still doesn't make sounds.
I'm dead silent.
It's actually very true. He lies very still and doesn't make any sounds.
It's alarming.
It's not surprising.
Yeah, maybe that's why I am refining my taste in queer film now. Like, I'm the only one here who does, like, love Simon. But that was because I did like that. It was just kind of a more mainstream.
It's your introduction to it.
That was what.
And again, that's maybe why it's important, is if that is your introduction to it, and then you go exploring more stuff afterwards.
Exactly.
Right.
And I just like that it was a more mainstream thing that everyone could see, and I didn't have to feel like ashamed. Like, I was growing, I was just going to go watch kind of like a teen movie in the cinema, and
absolutely.
I was accepted for that. Also, beautiful Kenan Lonsdale, our Kenan Lonsdale from Australia. God. So beautiful.
National treasure.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. We should definitely get him on the show.
Can I co-host then?
Yeah.
Thank you.
Weirdly, today I remembered another movie growing up, and it really stuck with me, but I didn't really realize it was a queer film at the time. But a movie called Running with Scissors.
It's
a memoir of Augustine Burroughs, and it was, I think, Ryan Murphy's first film.
Oh, wow.
But it has, like, a lot of famous people. It has Chenoweth, what's her name?
Kristen Chenoweth.
Yeah, yeah. And it has...
I think I've read that book.
Yeah, it's, like, really good. And then, like, the kid is gay in it, and then his mum has, like, she's a struggling poet, but she's, like, has all these mental issues, and she lets her therapist adopt him, and he gets absorbed into this, like, really crazy family. I think Gwyneth Paltrow's in it, Evan Rachel Wood's in it. And he starts dating a much older guy, and it's just a really bizarre, weird movie. And then his mom eventually ends up having multiple relationships with other women, but it's completely, like, seen really normal for some reason.
Can you please watch Party Monster?
Yes.
I feel like it reminds me a lot of some of your friends.
Okay. Yeah. I don't know how to take that yet, but I will get back to you with my offense.
The main storyline is about, like, a murderer.
Oh, yes, many
drug
murder
dealer
friends.
Thing. But I just feel like you're really
many
like,
murder friends. I remember we used to have a tradition of watching, like, really weird, fucked up movies on Christmas
Day. Don't watch Party Monster on Christmas Day. It's a bit depressing.
So we'd either watch, like, a horror movie or something weird on Christmas Day.
Yeah.
And we watched this one called The Short Bus.
It
was very long ago, but I just remember a lady had, like, a vibrating egg stuck inside her.
Yeah, no, it's, like, super queer and full of, like, actual sex.
Yeah, it was an awkward one.
That's the same director as Hedwig and the Angry Inch.
Yeah, I think that one's due for a rewatch as well.
Can I also mention my one last complaint about queer cinema?
Yes,
I just want to put it out there because I feel like I need to get it off my chest, is that I also kind of hate this weird trope where if you're making queer cinema or a quote-unquote gay film, that there has to be, like, a ton of gay sex in it, or explicit gay sex. And a few years ago,
I have no complaints about that.
I just find it so unnecessary to get it into a certain category. I saw a film a few years ago which was an independent gay film. If you took the explicit gay sex scenes out of that film,
would it
would literally just be a murder mystery.
Oh, right.
Like, it had no correlation. Yeah. And it was also very bizarre because it was set in a very small country town of maybe, you know, a population of 50, but there was at least 20 gay men. Like, young twinks living in this rural town.
What specifically is this film called?
I know you don't like Call Me By Your Name, Luke, but I know that movie, a lot of people were upset that they didn't show the sex, I think, in that movie.
Right.
But, like, I don't, to be honest, don't really have a problem with it. I don't think it was impacting the story, like, just beautiful setting and you know what happened.
I have a lot of thoughts on this topic.
Yeah, okay.
I definitely think, the first thing is, I think, when we grow up, we are so obsessively hungry for, like, not just imagery that reflects back to us, like, our own desires, but also, like, educationally, we are, like, how the fuck do I
perform
sex?
You fuck I'm a not, peach.
Exactly, which I highly recommend. But I think also in the film that I just made, as you've seen, there's a sort of shower scene moment. Mm. And it became this insane conversation, actually, about why it needed to be in the film. And also, I had this desire to show like an alternative version of like what two gay men can do,
you
know, sexually.
What I also liked about that scene, so if you, I don't want to give anything away, but just to explain the scene a little bit, is the couple that are on this weekend away in the shower, one's jerking off while the other one's sort of kissing the neck of the other one. What I liked about it was a much more realistic, like you see the sex scenes in the shower, and I think you can't fuck in the shower like that. Like, it's so hard to fuck in the shower. And also, when you're on a weekend away, you've probably fucked 20 times by the time you actually get into the shower.
That's why you're having the shower.
The last thing you want to do is actually have full-blown anal in the shower.
Oh boy.
And there's quite often you get in the shower after you've had like a 12-hour session and just jerk off. Do you want to go get a glass of water outside?
Come on.
You know, when you've had like a really long session, you get in the shower, you actually do just want to have like a jerk off or someone's kissing your neck, and you might not even come. It's just sort of like a bit of fun to do it.
Yeah.
I found that very realistic and quite lovely.
Thank you. So, yeah. Well, and I think I was really keen to show, I think I just feel this insane pressure to have sex that looks like porn in my actual life. And it never does. You know, I've tried to have sex in a shower and I like slid out of the shower. Yeah. It's just gone.
Things hurt. The lube always results in injury.
Absolutely. Yeah. And so,
and shampoo does not make a good lube. There's bubbles everywhere.
No, let's be honest. We've all done it though.
Yeah. Oh, oh God, I have substituted so many different things.
Oh, that
should
be a topic. Substitutes.
One more thing I'd really like to talk about is, whilst we don't want queer cinema to merge into mainstream cinema completely and lose our identity in it, I do think it is exciting that we are starting to see authentic queer characters in mainstream stuff. I think a lot of it's owed to streaming platforms like Netflix, because they are able to tailor things as mainstream as Sabrina was. I thought that her cousin character was like a he was sort of an all-sexual kind of character that was sort of subtly written in there, and it wasn't a huge thing. Yeah. I messaged you guys the other day when I was watching, and it's so bizarre that I'm bringing this up. Yeah. Like, Rocco's Modern Life, the cartoon from the night. Have you watched the special that they just did?
No, I haven't, but I've heard about it. I was reading
I hadn't read anything about it, it, and one of the characters from the original cartoon, so it was a kid's cartoon 20 years ago, or more, and they've done this special on Netflix, and one of the characters has now come out as trans in a kid's cartoon.
Wow.
And it was very authentic, and it didn't feel like they were trying to milk something or anything like that. They were just like, let's the real world now, so let's put it in there.
That's great.
I do think it's, whilst we want to still have our own genre of queer cinema, it is exciting that we're starting to see more authentic characters being written into
mainstream.
Wasn't it like Hey Arnold, they had the maths teacher got married to him recently?
Was that Hey Arnold?
Arthur.
Yeah. And look, that's probably not quite as authentic because it's written for kids, so it's a little bit like, but it's still really important that characters like that are being written
I think Jessica Jones as well, season three, just it's like scene three, there's just like a South Asian trans woman working in her office, no explanation.
Yeah, they don't have to feel like a big spotlight.
Wait, what's going on? This is amazing. I was watching with my mom and was like, who's this character? What's she doing? And then she just like exists in the show, and her narrative has nothing to do with her identity in any way. I got so excited. It almost made me kind of emotional.
I actually cried watching Rocko's Modern Life. So, it's not what I was expecting.
It's also so genre. Like, we are so often excluded from genre. And if we're in genre, it's like this weird token, like vampire lesbian. And you're like, no, that's yuck too. So it's really exciting to start seeing people putting us in work that is much more exciting and heightened, you know?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So we have a fan suggested topic, I guess, in a way. We had a listener write in to us about their experience being bullied.
Mm-hmm.
And I know in the past we've spoken about our experiences growing up and our childhood in school and some of the traumatic things we've gone through, but we haven't really ever spoken about being bullied in our adult lives.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, like in workspaces, with our friends, in gay environments.
Yeah.
I thought
podcasts
especially. it is still a big thing in our lives, and we go through it a lot.
It's absolutely a huge thing. It's actually surprising that we haven't talked about it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I know I definitely have. In hindsight, I was like, oh yeah, I was pretty bad actually.
Yeah.
Back when I worked in hospitality like years ago, I worked for a small like Italian restaurant. It was like a family owned one. I think the husband worked in the kitchen and then the wife ran the front of house, and she was such a monster to me. She was so mean all the time. And Very inconsistent. Literally once she wouldn't let me leave. Oh, she kept me back late.
Yeah.
And then I missed my last bus and I had to walk home in a thunderstorm at 10 o'clock at night. So,
Do you feel like there was any connection to that in your sexuality?
You know, I think it's weird because I don't have many memories of being bullied at school, and I feel like I didn't really show my gayness at school and I wasn't comfortable with it, so it was always being hidden. And then in my adult life, I guess maybe I've been slowly becoming more comfortable with it, so showing it to more people, and people have maybe picked up on that. I know when I eventually got really upset and I was like, I can't do this anymore, like the abuse, and my brother suggested that I get a job where he was working at the time, which is David Jones, a big department store in Australia. And I gave her my, like, psyched up the courage, gave her my 2 weeks notice, even though I think I was casual. I could have literally left on the day, but I was like doing the nice thing, 2 weeks. And then I remember she was just making all these like sneery comments about how like, oh, I can just imagine you spritzing perfume at the, like, didn't even tell her what my role was. Actually, like selling electronics. But she was making weird snide little comments, spritzing perfume at people walking by and just like making me like really uncomfortable.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah. Bullying as adults is prolific. Like it is so common. It's happening all the time, and we don't really acknowledge it. And perhaps as gay men, I can't talk for other members of the LGBT community, but I assume it's probably very similar. Maybe we turn a blind eye to it because we are so used to it from childhood and that sort of thing, and we are used to sort of being on the outskirts of mainstream society that we just sort of feel like that's part and parcel of being gay men.
I would hypothesize also that you grow up trying to please and trying to accommodate people's uncomfortability with your sexuality in the first place. So when things aren't going well, it's not maybe your... I mean, this is me personally. It's not my first reaction to call something out. If it's directed at me, I usually will double down on my accommodating niceness because I'm like, you must like me, please. And then therefore endure this stuff much longer than it needs to go on.
I feel like often when it's heterosexual on gay bullying. When it's sort of and it's definitely something I have experienced in the workplace, both in my various day jobs and also working in entertainment as well. And I think this is a hangover, but we've talked about it before, of this preconceived ideas that people have always had about gay men, about that we don't live fulfilling lives and we don't have, we don't contribute. We sort of are the camp sort of fun sidekick, but we're never really realistically considered. And it's a very passive aggressive form of bullying, but it's never, we're never really considered seriously for, you know, a role, or even from family members and friends, you know, they don't really rely on us because we're sort of the, you know, we're the fun ones that drink and party and that sort of stuff. And, you know, we're good for a
role to fill.
But we won't ask them to do something important or serious. And then there's also gay on gay bullying as well, which is very groups. And that's even more sort of complicated, I guess. Possibly comes from that, you know, that saying, hurt people hurt people. Maybe it does go back to that high school thing, you know, a lot of us didn't get the opportunity to develop socially the same way that everybody else did in school. And so you sort of often see guys when they finally get a chance to join the gay scene acting like they're in grade five, picking on each other and sort of trying to be part of the cool clique and that sort of thing. And some of us grow out of it. And look, I'll be honest, like I probably was part of that when I was younger. I hope that I've grown out of it by now, but you sort of see people that...
some people don't.
Well, actually, in a way, you're right, though, because like, you know, even at this podcast, we rag on each other a little bit and that's quite fun. RuPaul's Drag Race, our most celebrated queer culture show, is... you know, the best quotes of the season are always someone bullying the other one.
Like, and absolutely it's done devastating somebody.
And it's done tongue in cheek and stuff, but that's very much part of our culture. And even to go back to queer cinema, the seminal Australian gay film is Priscilla, Queen of the Desert. And the entire script is Bernadette ragging on Adam for being a naive and twink, Adam ragging on Bernadette for being older and trans, and both of them ragging on Tick for not being comfortable with his sexuality. It is very much part of gay culture.
And I think it has there's also a rich history to that sort of that insult humor as well that we all kind of and I know you guys have spoken about it on the podcast before as well, that sort of, you know, sledging each other. I think what I find particularly in the workplace is that once you open that door to a straight man who thinks that is how you, that is your currency,
I can say it,
the door is open both ways and suddenly you're going, have I set a trap by letting this person think,
or is that my safety? Like, is that my way of sort of laughing it off? It's actually, well, so true. And maybe we do learn that. Like, I know a lot of queer culture is about being self-deprecating. Absolutely. A lot of drag culture is self-deprecating and that sort of stuff. And maybe that comes from like when we're growing up, you know, you always make the joke about yourself first because then no one else can do it.
I agree.
And once you start doing that in the workplace, you're actually right. I hadn't thought about that. You sort of, you're the character at work where it's like, well, you know, I'm sure Tom's going out this weekend, you know. But I guess in a way that is sort of a form
but
of bullying.
But I think I'm becoming more guarded with who I actually relax around in that way, you know, like, because in effect, I end up being quite disappointed if somebody takes that and goes, oh, I can say this word or I can do this to you. And I end up going, well, actually, you can't. And you should know the nuance here.
You need
which
to know
is
the line.
You know, exactly. But it's hard to have that conversation socially or like, it happened to me at dinner recently. Somebody ordered an affogato and, you know, I always read it out loud as a fagato because I think it's funny. And that's whatever. It's a lol. And then it sort of, it got thrown around the table a little bit. And suddenly there was people who aren't in the queer community saying it.
Yeah,
and,
then it's uncomfortable.
You know, having a laugh. And then I started kind of seizing up and was like, actually, fuck, like I really fucked up.
Like, yeah.
And you feel like you've opened the door.
But it shouldn't be that. It shouldn't be. You are allowed to say it, and it doesn't automatically mean that you're giving a pass for everyone else.
Correct.
To use that
correct.
Kind of language.
I think it's just that there's a, I don't know. There's an interesting culture.
I totally get what you mean.
Yeah.
I think there's a difference between reading and bullying. Bullying.
Do you know the difference?
And, yeah, because I've spent a lot of years bullying.
Yeah, you're doing it right now.
Yeah. And I think there's a systematic and an intent that isn't present when reading. You know, bullying, especially in the workplace, it can be subconscious, but the intent to place someone at a lower level or
like
to make
moves,
them, a power move, or to purposefully make them feel uncomfortable in a certain circumstance. I worked in an office like years and years ago where I think they just never matured out of the 90s. So calling something gay was really just like part of the vernacular. Yeah. Like, oh, this is so gay. I got an email at 5 o'clock. And so it got to a certain point where I stood up, and this is in an open plan office space. There were, I think, maybe 30 of us in the room. And I said, guys, there's a gay person. And I was the only gay person working there. So there's a gay person in the room.
Yeah.
And gay is not a synonym for dumb or bad.
Yeah, that's good. Good on you.
It's my sexuality. Unfortunately, things have only improved for about 2 weeks before it went
and slipped back
into that, and I realized I'm not going to fight this battle. I don't have the energy. It's not my place. These are adults who should know better. I just need a different environment to work in. In a weird way, I did feel uncomfortable and almost bullied out of that workspace, which is different to the bullying or the reading that happens here, which is
to a degree. But I feel like it's sort of a spectrum, I guess.
Yeah.
And by opening yourself up and sort of doing the reads on yourself or whatever, it can give people the feeling that they're allowed to.
And then you're like, too much.
And they think that they're being funny, but they're actually
sometimes,
taking it as permission.
Yeah. Sometimes I still do it. Sometimes if I'm in a heterosexual space and like I drop something, I'll be like, oh my god, that's so gay. And I'll see
you're like, damn it, I'm
and
the problem.
I'll see the straight people freeze up because they're like, oh, we're not allowed to say that anymore.
Yeah.
And I was talking to one of my colleagues about it specifically the other day, and I said, I do it because I want them to know I remember that they grew up using that word. And it's only since they got quote unquote woke 5 or so years ago that isn't cool. But I ain't forgotten.
I think you're hitting like a brand of humor that I like revel in, which is to like weaponize that sort of stuff against people, make them uncomfortable. You know, a lot of my job is schmoozing in a foyer or something, which makes me crazy. And so a lot of the time I'm like, who can I make really uncomfortable? And I usually end up just kind of throwing stuff like that around. Probably works against me, but anyway, it is definitely a brand. I was going to say, I like the film industry is, if you didn't know this, which you probably do, is populated by like alpha men and is famously exclusionary against people like us. And I've found, I had a specific experience about 2 years ago directing a film, my first feature film, where we had a first AD come on board, and a first AD is the assistant director, and he basically just yells at everyone and tells them what to do. That's the traditionally the role. And he was, you know, ex-military, 40 years old, came onto this super queer film set that's an autobiographical film about my mum's and meant a lot to me and all of this stuff. And I could just tell straight away that he was never going to listen to me. He just didn't want to hear what I had to say. And it's so, we're constantly navigating that. I mean, we fired him after 3 days because he made so many people cry. And he second-guessed everything I said and all of this. And I think it's particularly intense in this industry.
When I was about 17, dad got me a job working as a brickies labourer on my uncle's building site.
Yeah,
super.
And I think it was just definitely dad trying to sort of straighten me out a little bit. He said, "Oh, you know," because I was like, "Oh, I need some money to buy stuff," and he was like,
"To buy drag stuff. I need a new wig, Dad." Yeah.
He's like, "Wow."
And I bullied all the brickies. And
it's like twist.
Yeah,
in drag.
Yeah, I rocked up in a full sequin gown for the first day, and but I went to this thing and it was like fully grown men working on a construction site, brickies, and I was there to be the shit kicker. They were talking about overtly homophobic stuff, and I was camp, and it was clearly being done like to make me feel really uncomfortable about bashing faggots and that sort of stuff, like really aggressive stuff, to the point where I was supposed to do it for the whole summer holidays. I lasted 3 days and was like, "Dad, I can't go back," and didn't go back. And literally since then, I've never worked in, like, I've always tried to find a job, you know, gay bars, retail, Supre, and then, you know, in theatre as I got older and that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
And I think it's because of that experience and I mean, imagine, like, as an adult now, thinking of bullying a 17-year-old on a construction site when your uncle is his uncle is the boss, having the balls to do that.
What a big man you must feel.
Yeah, exactly. What the fuck made you feel... you had to do that. Yeah.
I feel lucky now that my work environment is so celebrated to be gay, because there are quite a few queer people that work in our company. My boss is like the biggest ally I know, and she's so encouraging. And like, you just know, like, if there was any kind of issue, she would like a 1,000,000% have your back.
You're also white.
I have always.
You never point that out. Thanks. Yeah.
Love that.
I have also seen the reverse sort of situation, though, where you might have a predominantly gay, especially when I was working retail in my early 20s, gay male environment where, you know, heterosexual women or lesbian women might be bullied as well for not being part of a clique that was sort of the cool part, which is a huge issue too.
And in reverse, I'd also say that I've been bullied by a lot of heterosexual women
in jobs
as well.
Yeah.
And
I think as human beings, we try to like replicate things that are known to us. I think that's why a lot of these high school behaviors, like we've thrown away the word, it feels like high school or it feels like a teenage thing, is because I think when we become adults, I think officers often just become high school 2.0 for a lot of people. The same sort of cliques and the same sort of social rules come into play really quickly when you put a group of people in to a space and they have to interact with each other every day. They revert to what they know.
Mm-hmm.
And for gay people, that is a minor role or a hidden role. And for some people, it's an alpha role. It's just, I think, a shitty part of human nature that we tend to do that.
Yeah.
I think the topic and all of the examples are so broad that it shows that bullying is not this kind of like very specific thing that a very specific
type of...
There's
so many different types of bullying.
That it's not, we are all picturing the straight man... You know, the white straight man doing this, but it comes in so many different forms. I think it's really important to also think about how we react to bullying and what we can do when we see bullying. Mm. So my story wasn't a very good example because I acted and it didn't have effect. But I think something that's really important that I saw on Twitter the other day is the ripple effect of when other people see someone stand up to bullying is that it creates an atmosphere that it's okay. Pussy stood up.
Jesus.
That person stood up to a bully and they're still alive. The world hasn't ended and they were heard. It may not have like had the huge change effect they wanted, but it means it's okay for me to then do that when I feel uncomfortable. And so I've always kind of thought that if I'm ever in that workplace again, even though it didn't play out the way I wanted it to, it's not necessarily going to stop me from doing that again.
Yeah, agreed.
Because there could be someone else in that workplace.
But I think also our protocols are changing. I would say most workplaces now have a person you can literally go to or somebody.
Yeah, unfortunately, at my workplace, that's me. So
that's great. I would come to you with my problems. Yeah. Totally.
I have a memory of my ex-boyfriend, his mom hated me. And it was just subtle things I could never say anything about because I couldn't go up against his mom.
That's a power move. No, you've got to take the mum down.
Yeah, take her down. But she, I think she was like a born-again Christian, from America, Southern Belle. And he came out to his mum while I was dating him. So I feel like she always blamed me, even though he was clearly gay. Not out to the blind and deaf.
But I mean, I think that goes back to that subtle kind of bullying. Yeah, that's very...
just like little jeers and
even just not thinking of you as being at the same... So for me, both my parents are from very big Catholic families, and I do definitely have extended family members who don't really want to know what's going on in my life, and they don't really take me seriously. Like, they'll say to my brothers, oh, how's the family, how's the kids, how's the job, how's that sort of stuff, and they'll say to me, hey Tom, how are you going? Like, they're not interested because they don't want to know about my life. And whilst it doesn't sound like it's bullying, like prodding you in the chest and saying, oh, you're dumb, it's sort of a form where it's like, oh, I don't really consider you to be living the equal kind of life that us heterosexual people are living. So I definitely have experienced it from family members, but it's not as direct. I mean, besides my grandmother, my dead grandmother telling my mum that it's her fault that I'm gay and that she influenced the whole thing. Aside from that, there's never been anything direct.
Yeah.
She's dead now, I can say that. So we're at the end of the show. Of course, we do have our after show. If you are a Patreon member, if you want to sign up at patreon.com/gaysrevoltingpod, we're going to talk about gay beats.
Woo!
I'm kind of shocked that we've been doing this podcast for over a year and have not talked about gay beats specifically. No, we've talked about a bit of public sex and stuff, but not gay beats as a specific topic. I want to talk about the history of gay beats. I want to talk about the importance that we have of gay beats in our culture. I want to talk about where to find gay beats.
I heard that this podcast was a gay beat.
Well, as soon as we finish, we turn off the lights and take off our pants. So
there's a lock on that door.
So if you do want to, if we want to listen to that, sign up for our Patreon. But before we do that, Thomas, thanks so much for coming along. You're going to join us for the after show.
Absolutely.
Very excited to hear your opinion on gay beats and all the experience you have.
Great.
If people want to follow you on socials, where can they find that?
I am at Thomas Wilson White on Instagram. And a quick shout out to the Growing Up Queer in Australia book that's just come out. I highly recommend everyone get a copy. It's
fantastic.
Beautiful.
And you've got a piece in there as well.
I do have a piece in there.
Exciting.
Apologies to my dad, who he'll never read it. So
it's fine. You're safe.
Well, thanks for joining us, boys. Lovely to see you again.
And don't forget to follow our socials at Gays Revolting Pod on Instagram, or join our closed Facebook group, The Gays Are Revolting.
And if anyone's seen my iPod Classic, it's 120 gigabytes. It's black. I left it at a tram stop about 2 weeks ago.
No. Do you know which one?
No.
Okay, cool. Thank you. Thanks so much, everybody.
Bye, guys.
Bye.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.